This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thank you, John. This suit, which I know isn't suited to a Saturday morning in Canberra, is not some unconscious deference to Manning, I don't think. It's because I have to go to a wedding in Yarraside, as Manning would say. I've spent the last 2 weeks in Western Queensland, They talk different, them bastards, You'd think you were in Wellington, if it weren't for the spinifex and grasshoppers, I was with a man who's a Vietnam veteran, Kalkadoon, Afghan, Irish and Welsh, a ringer, a tailor, a potty dodger, a miner, a prospector, a geologist, self-taught, and now a very successful mineral surveyor. His language would be blue in this context. One word, one unutterable word in nearly all contexts, is like birdsong in that bush. And it does for sheep, cattle, various grasses and trees, rocks, friends, children, everything. And it has no more connection to the female reproductive organ than bloody does to Jesus Christ anymore. It's like a sort of song, and it goes with a familiar adjective. It forms two-thirds of every word, of their entire language, as far as I could tell. Now, by virtually all measures, this is impoverished language, I suppose. Yet it does very well for the people who speak it. They can tell a story in it, and they can amuse themselves, and they certainly amused me. Now, down the road from... He's at Mount Isa, and the spinifex country. Down the road is the Mitchell grass country, what's left of the Mitchell grass. At the Hughenden Museum, which announces itself as celebrating 500 million years of history and culture. Now, think about that. I don't know which part's history and which part's culture, but it's 500 million years represented there. Most of it in a visual display that tells the story of Porcupine Gorge, a gorge, a miniature Grand Canyon, they say, or our own Grand Canyon. It tells how the rocks were formed. It starts with the Big Bang, really, and then the dinosaurs take up several million years. And finally, it tells the story of, I think this is where we get to the culture, of the sheep industry, the pastoral industry. Nowhere, you'll notice, in that 500 million years of history and culture, the 50 or 60,000 years of Aboriginal occupation. One section concerns one Captain Robert Gray, a cousin of the great explorer of this area, or that is, the great exploiter of the area. I'm trying to think of his name and it just escaped me. Ernest, what's his name? Like him, Robert Gray came from India and set up the first station at Hughenden. He brought his two sisters with him. Now, the founders of the museum, assuming that this man spoke very fine, formal Victorian English, have done an audio presentation for everyone. And in it, they have... they've found some dulcet-toned local actor to read a sort of faux letter from Gray to his genteel friends in England, in which he describes how splendid it is there on the frontier and all his aspirations and what opportunities it presents for any man of enterprise. And just to add to the effect, they put some bark cello behind it. It's all lovely. It looks across at the shearing machines, the Wolseley shearing heads and those sorts of things, and pictures of hairy shearers. Now, it just happened that a few months ago in the Queensland Library, I read the letters that Robert Gray's sisters, who were also at Hughenden, that they wrote. And all the way through them, they refer to Robert being out hunting blacks. She says it's sorry, but it has to be done. She says it's a sad thing, but it has to be done. They just give us endless trouble. And so they're out hunting blacks. And then at one stage, he brings home two children that he's captured. And he's going to dress in livery and raise as servants, slaves, basically, to help the Kanakas, who he's also got working there. He feeds them out of a trough every night, milk. And it also turns out from these letters, it becomes very clear that Robert is not really running his sheep and making his fortune and clearing the Aboriginals for the glory of empire and the advancement of civilization, but to make a quick financial kill so he can return to England and buy his way into the gentry, which is what a great many of the settlers in Western Queensland and elsewhere in Australia were doing. And the point I'm trying to make here is not really a political one, but rather that language concerns power. Even dressed up with bark, what it's trying to do. The language of Grey is the language of a man of vast superiority, real and assumed. The language of my friend, the former potty dodger, is a language in which it seems to me he has wrapped himself. His great-grandmother, by the way, was one of the very few survivors as a child of the massacre on Battle Hill, where he took us. It's quite possible that Robert Gray was present there. Maybe he didn't go that far west. But in a way, his language is also a language related to power. That is, he lives inside it, he expresses his rebellion, and in some ways his lower status in this language. And to learn anything from him, one has to enter into the general profanity. To speak the language that one speaks in middle-class white society won't do at all. You'll get nowhere. To earn respect, you have to sort of live with the language of the time. Just as you would have to drop the profanity to live with Robert Gray's circle or to marry one of his sisters. Anyway, look, I'm sorry I don't have PowerPoint, speaking of power. But I'm glad to see that Manning Clark House seems to have it on call. 3 weeks ago, I spoke to a Victorian government department which was holding an all-day in-house seminar, that is, for its internal customers. I don't know whether Manning Clark House has seminars for their internal customers, but they probably should. And it was at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I arrived at 5:02 and picked up a brochure and read it, and it said this. They'd invited me to come and speak to them because they wanted to do something about their in-house language. Their internal customers were getting sick of it. Anyway, there it was. It was this very glossy brochure, and it said, it was a message from the head of the department. It said, "For the past 3 months, we've been focusing heavily on strategic planning for 2010-2014. I'm excited by our new vision, quote, to be a catalyst for continuous improvement in the accountability and performance of the public sector, supported by our values." It's only recently that we've been supported by our values. Our values: integrity, personal accountability, teamwork, learning, and being outcome-focused. It's even more recently that our value is being described as being outcome-focused, or being outcome-focused has become a value. If you're not outcome-focused, you perhaps should leave the room now. I look forward to working together over the next 5 years toward achieving our vision through the implementation of our key priorities. Now, you can imagine the staff, the internal customers, reading this and trying to share in the general excitement that he's feeling. He goes on to say it will be challenging and that he's confident a rewarding year, and really, I don't believe it. Anyway, I'd no sooner finished reading this than he arrived. He's got a picture of him here, and he took me into the in-house seminar. Then I met all the internal customers sitting there in the dark with a large PowerPoint presentation up there, all in dot points. Now, you know, all PowerPoint presentations are in dot points because we don't want verbs anywhere at all, if possible. And we know also that a bullet point adds a lot of, truth to it. You know, it's much truer than a sentence, a bullet point. Sentences are just woolly sorts of things, whereas a bullet point, you know, gets to the nub of things. It actually does the opposite, but we won't worry about that for now. You know, it's a funny sort of thing, and people said words of bullets, and somebody famously said that a period is like a bullet. I can't remember who it was. But anyway, they've taken it and made a bullet like a piece of fairy floss. And what was curious was that he did some housekeeping first, as they say, and he had a description of what they were going to do during the day, and it was all written up there in bullet points, and yet he took everyone through it. And he read each bullet point out to them as if they were all visually impaired. And I felt like I was back in grade one, which is, you know, the teacher would write it on the board and then read it to you so that you learn to read. Anyway, they were doing it there in this with these internal customers, and they that outlined the day, and then he had another slide come up and it outlined me in bullet points. It was a bullet-pointed biography of me, and it seemed to me at least 50% wrong. But we always feel that about our biographies, I suppose, but some people do anyway. Bullet points seem to me to drop most of the meaning of things. Edward Tufte, a Harvard guru of management, says that the use of PowerPoint, he says, is actually reducing steadily the cognitive ability of American business people. He points out, for instance, that if bullet points had been used by those who recorded the progress of the Black Death, we would know only a very small proportion of what we know about the Black Death because it was recorded in sentences. That, in fact, bullet points lose meaning, and PowerPoint in general, as he says, won't do for anything except... won't do well for anything except making it possible to look like you're listening while you're actually thinking of something else. Now, management language in general does this. This is my complaint. I would go further than John Stanhope in this. I don't think it's not bureaucratic language that concerns me. I think bureaucrats have a perfect right to say anything they like. I had a letter from one recently which said, "We have placed your application on hold within our systems while the works are performed. The estimated completion date is TBA. However, this date may be moved forward or back." "Depending on demand and availability of equipment." I think any language which amuses the people who write it is fine by me. Legal language. Legal language amuses lawyers, and John Mortimer showed that you could amuse a lot more than lawyers if you use it well. And legal language, and even bureaucratic language for the most part, until the so-called management revolution, did have its roots, as far as I can tell, in English itself. That it had a common provenance with the colloquial language that other people speak. It was not so far divorced from the vernacular. It was a vernacular of its own, in a way. Whereas the language of managerialism, it seems to me, has no roots in English at all. It's entirely newfangled. It's made up. It's so thoroughly depleted in the centre that it contains quite deliberately no meaning. It's a series of semaphores. You could easily swap it. Most of the phrases of management language, you could substitute a sheep's head or just a piece of old rag or something and just exchange it. It doesn't really do anything. And it has no problems. You can't write a poem in this language. Some people could. You can't set it to music, as Tuff pointed out. You know, if you try to do the Gettysburg Address in PowerPoint, it just won't work. It won't work. Whereas it seems to me that the language of some of our politicians now would be better in PowerPoint. I would rather they did it in dot points. I think soon we will see people appearing on Kerry O'Brien with a PowerPoint slide behind them. And what I mean, Kerry, is, and I'll do this. And Kerry will probably get his own slides because he doesn't like anyone one-upping him. But if you take a sentence like this, customer experience, and this is one of the important things about managerial language, is that it begins with this idea that everyone is a customer, including and internal customer. Everyone is a customer, because all you're doing in this world is selling and buying. Customer experience, a focus on planned, consistent customer experiences that embody, I won't tell you the brand at this moment, the brand, and lead to optimum outcomes in terms of customer contentment. And improvements in customer circumstances reflecting desired policy outcomes. That's in brackets, that last bit. This has been an engine room for innovation across our network. Through our focus on corporate performance, the service quality to cost index will provide us with an indicator of the implementation and effectiveness of better practice with a direct impact on value for money. We quality assure our culture to build the trust and understanding of our staff. We monitor adherence to the Australian Public Service Values Framework and the Centrelink expectation statement and our shared behaviours. It's not a private company at all. It's Centrelink. Their external customers are the unemployed. Not called the unemployed. Job seekers. Job seekers they are. You'll never see the word unemployed in any Centrelink document. They're job seekers. Look, I'm sorry, love, but I've become a job seeker. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. I've got to. Still, I see Centrelink is offering optimum outcomes in terms of customer contentment. I'll get myself down there. An engine room down there. Everything will be all right. I'll just suffer a category management initiative and I've just been downsized a little, right-sized. Also from Centrelink, the Centrelink contact point for statistics, previously known as the Centrelink Knowledge Desk, is now known as the Business Intelligent Front Door. Now, you know about the power of language. I mean, you can just turn a desk into a door just like that. Just write a little memo, and away it goes. And you come in the morning, and an internal customer, and thinks, where's the door gone? So, in the end, all this language begins to sound the same. And it's not just in the public service. But if here we have the city of Port, local government. Let's try the Department of Treasury and Finance. It is important here in the Department of Treasury, it's important that we all demonstrate behaviours reflective of both the organisational aspirations of the department and the specific work accountabilities, deliverables and outputs of which we are individually responsible. Of which. The Department of Treasury in Victoria now describes itself as an agile department. I don't know whether any of you are finance officers or have met them from the Department of Finance, but agile was never the first word that came to mind when I was having to deal with them. The police force. We are committed to the ongoing professionalisation of our profession. The purpose of the state's sustainability strategy is to illustrate how the state government will respond to the sustainability agenda by adopting the sustainability framework and highlighting actions across government. You don't care what it says. That give meaning to the framework. Round and round we go. By focusing the strategy on agency activity, the state government is demonstrating its important leadership role in supporting the transition to a sustainable future. Well, it's not. And if it is, it's not in there. You know. So what this language does, it turns everything into abstract nouns and composite portmanteau sorts of nouns, hung together with a few weak or non-existent verbs. and some awful cliched adjectives, and often very strange adjectives, like delightful. Or contented for a customer. I suppose it's all right to be a contented customer, but it sounds a little passive. Politicians begin to sound the same way. You know, here's a couple we're familiar with. These pilots will trial or expand initiatives that exemplify strategies to improve literacy and numeracy outcomes for those students most in need of support. Now, the problem with that sentence is part may be that no one cares anymore. But really, if you read it five times, you still don't know what it is they're trying to say. It creates a sort of anesthetic effect at once. And yet the words, you know, the word initiative is in there, which sort of suggests something a little more dynamic, but it doesn't have anything dynamic about it, initiative, anymore. And, of course, it has the necessary outcomes. Everything is now an outcome. We are all, in our way, outcomes. We're the product of a successful birth event. And a non-adverse outcome in that regard. Well, that's not the whole existential answer, but it's sort of part of it. That was Kevin and Julia together offering that explanation of how they're going to help people read and write, which when you look at it the 17th time, you realise that's what they're saying. We will teach kids to read and write. But it wouldn't sound good enough, would it, really? Imagine saying that. Or you have somebody talking about there's a couple of CEOs, probably on $3 or $4 million a year from Ernst & Young. The priority we place on our people is what drives our quality performance and profitable growth. This is nonsense. It's not that at all. It's got nothing to do with placing priorities on people. Absolutely nothing to do with it. And in 2004, we made considerable investments in our people initiatives. There it is again. Central to this was an accelerated collaborative event, which enabled a broad cross-section of our people to have input into our people approach. Now, someone has sat down and written this. This isn't just off the cuff. They've actually prepared this, and it's been checked by several people all the way up to the top. And the CEO has put his name at the bottom of it. That's resulted in 6 project teams working to embed the key initiatives across our firm, and so on. They mention Harvard here. Valuable leadership program for our key leaders, and on and on it goes, and so on. It goes on. Well, you know all this stuff. You know, there's, Titan is very proud of its reputation for excellence and commitment to upholding the highest ethical standards. As always, Titan's ultimate success in both of these areas begins and ends with our greatest resource, our team of highly qualified talent. They share core values. Now, Titan is one of the rottenest companies in the world. It's always in court all over the world. It made huge profits out of the Iraq War. It and Blackwater and CACI, they were involved in the business at Abu Ghraib. You can't find a more rotten company unless it's Halliburton or Enron. Blackwater itself, Blackwater's so rotten they've had to change their name. They're now called ZZXEZ. They just changed it overnight. They even took their mission statement down. They're going to write a new one because it's become laughable even by their standards. Now, the curious thing is, you know, when you have this sort of thing, and they talk about customers, you know, all the time. Halliburton, you know, additionally, our success also depends on our business execution, practicing personal accountability and discipline while delivering projects to our customers, and most importantly, do not forget our focus on ethical standards, exemplifying honesty and integrity in all that we do. Exactly. You know. CACI, placing integrity and honesty above all else, putting clients first. You can substitute. That's the first one, and then there's the second. You can have putting clients first and then placing integrity and honesty above all else. And then if you give it a moment's thought, you think, hang on, if you're putting clients first and you're putting integrity and honesty above all else, haven't you got a little bit of a problem here? Because if you're really committed to your clients, can you always be committed to your ethics? Well, all you do is you change them around. You get your values lined up with your goals, and then your goals with your outcomes, and if your outcomes are crook, well, then you move your values. What's curious is we never had to do this before. We never had to line our values up with our goals. He never would have got out the door. We'd still be at Circular Quay. Wouldn't be a bad thing, quite probably. Committed to high ethical... Well, CACI is also in court all the time. And it just... It runs on... This is my point about the spread of it. Mission statements would have to be the silliest thing we've done in the last 100 years, mission statements. Mission statements. But they now use them in schools. Kids learn them in grade 2. They write a class mission statement. In Victoria, I don't know what they do in the ACT, but in Victoria they write the class mission statement. I've got one here, but if I find it, I'll read it out to you. Then you laminate it and put it on your desk or up on the wall. You talk about the kids all having to have the same common purpose, all sharing the same values. Why do you want that? It's a very strange thing. Universities want mission statements and everyone sharing the same goals and the common purpose. In other words, the universities and colleges and education departments have taken, and public service bodies everywhere, have taken on the idea that really the perfect model for managing their business is the private sector model got up in the 1980s. A model for a profit-making organisation. Now, this is all the stranger because there are so many models of successful educational organisations and research organisations which work to an entirely different model. The Rockefeller Institute does not run and never has run to a private sector organisational model. It didn't tell every scientist who they brought in there that they all had to sign up to the mission statement and share certain core values. At all. They should get on with your work, do what you like. Go for it. Don't worry about our missions, anything. We haven't got one. Well, they got 26 Nobel Prizes out of this sort of operation, and their contribution to the human life is considerably more, I would think, than CACI or Titan or any of the others. But which language do we, the organisational model we choose to imitate, it seems to me just the wrong one. And the same goes for public service departments and for politicians. Here is the Victorian planning minister who was caught out because he's one of his advisors, a genius no doubt, sent out an email saying, look, which said quite explicitly, we'll run the public consultation first and then we'll do what we like. And Madden came out and said, in order to address any perception issues created by this poorly worded sentence, by which he means it was a silly thing to do. Doesn't mean it was grammatically poor. it let the cat out of the bag. In order to address any perception issues created by this poorly worded sentence, I've instructed my department to appoint an independent probity audit. Or to oversee the application process, by which time you're dropping off again. But it's a... So the problem is not that... If the private sector wants to talk like this and run themselves like this, that's their business. I feel sorry for their internal customers and their external customers. But the more worrying thing is that the language escaped. It did. It's like a virus. It was spread. It spread everywhere. And it's easy enough to see how, because in the 1980s and 90s, as we all know, we privatised a lot of the public sector, and what remained of the public sector took on the habits of the private sector with all the zeal of the new convert. So the public sector, it seems to me, became mad about this stuff. And the worst examples of it are now in the public sector. Although if you read the Financial Review and just read the state, just work through all the stuff in quotations from chief executives in the Financial Review, they all say exactly the same thing from page one to the end. Just the same thing. And the point to be made here is there's no need to say anything else. The bottom line's fine. The business is still run. Language has nothing to do with it. Just as their mission statements have nothing to do with the way they behave. Or all their emphasis on our people has nothing to do with our people. It comes to the most extreme thing where you have to actually teach people the new language. In the Tasmanian Public Service, they have to explain the language that they're perfectly well. They can manage with their own language, but they have to learn this stuff. So they say things like, target outcomes are expressed as a sentence in the past, tense and usually start with a word ending in ED. These are grown-ups. Many of them have 2 degrees. And usually start, and one or two will have MBAs. This was no doubt written by someone with one of those MBAs. And usually start with a word ending in ED, such as improved, increased, or enhanced. There's a word for you. Framing target outcomes in this way makes it easy to determine their success measure. Well, we work on that. Determining their success measure. Outputs are the products, services, business or management practices that will be required or produced to meet the identified outcomes or benefits. They say you can't follow that. You just cannot get into it. You cannot get inside that at all. It remains outside all the time. Outcomes are the benefits or other long-term changes that are sought from undertaking the project. They are achieved from the utilisation of the project's outputs. Outcomes are linked with objectives in that if the outcomes are achieved, then the project's objectives have been met. Among other things, who cares? Now, it seems to me how this happened, I think, is roughly like this. Management's always been looking for ways to run things better. Henry Ford, all that, you know, Napoleon Hill, Dale Carnegie, all these sorts of ideas. And out of it in the 1980s came people like Tom Peters and Peter Drucker, who said, this is the way to run a company in future. But at the same time, it wasn't just about running a company more efficiently, they recognised that what you were doing was you were handling something altogether new, and that was information. And you had to have something to move this information around. And the trouble was, I mean, it had to be language. How else can you do it? You have to use language up to a point. But the language is the worst possible thing for moving information around the way you want it moved, because language is also has room for imagination, and you don't want that in what is essentially an assembly line. You don't want people running off into sentences. Language actually encourages thought. Once you get a hold of it, you start thinking things you hadn't thought before you started using it. This is dangerous. And you can understand that there are good reasons for why people want to keep it abstract, pseudo-scientific, and to dull it, make it as dull as possible. Language is unreliable. It makes people actually see complexity where you don't want them to see complexity, or to see simplicity when you actually want them to think it's impossibly complex and you won't think any more about it because it's too hard. So my argument is really not to say these people are horrors and should be in stocks, although that's not such a bad idea. It's really to say, well, you know, that there is this systemic assault on language, that the problems we now have with this appallingly dull management speak, which is spread everywhere, come from a sort of economic necessity, which is the transmission of information, masses of information, and having people writing who have never had to write before, and an education system which doesn't provide them with that facility anyway. In fact, an education system which has rolled over completely in the front of the assault of management and has now become totally managerialised itself. I mean, it's become avid. Try and read the curriculum. 70% of Tasmanian school teachers in an internal poll say they cannot understand the curriculum at all and don't know what they're teaching from one day to the next. And cannot write, literally cannot write, the great majority of them, a class report, a school report, the report on a child. They cannot write the sentences. You know, Johnny has been good, but he needs to do better. They can't write this anymore. And they're not allowed to write it. The classroom reports are written by a computer, whatever you call it, knowledge bank or something. And, of course, the parents can't understand it, and the teachers can't understand it, and the kid can't understand it, so it's perfect. So there's something going wrong, and I don't know whether they're doing it in Tasmania yet, but I'm sure in some places they're writing going forwards at the end of it. Johnny going forward. Archbishop Pell, Cardinal Pell, rather. ended his pastoral, his Advent letter in 2009, 2008, "May the Lord be with you going forwards." And when you, I read that bit first, it doesn't matter where you read, you can start any document these days at the back or the front or in the middle, it doesn't matter. And it was plain from the language of the Advent letter that it had been done by a consultant, at least in part. The whole history of the Catholic Church has never been necessary to say going forwards before. In fact, it was never necessary for anyone to say it. It was just assumed that we are sort of going forwards. Now it's just everywhere, going forwards. We're like lemmings, like trout going upstream to spawn. It's amazing you're here, really, when you could be going forwards. Until now, until about 1994, human beings just milled about. We're lost, just milled around in circles. Now, there is that word learnings too. I mean, we used to learn. We were taught, but now we have learnings, as you know. That's why this book is called Bendable Learnings. I don't know. Do kids now go home and their parents say, "What were your learnings today, sonny? Any key learnings, lad, you know?" All right. I think I'm probably... Tell me when I should be asking for questions, Bez. I'll just keep going for a minute or two more and then I'll ask... We'll go for it. In Victoria last year, I want to make 2 points. That, you know, you can laugh about that. It's the only thing to do is to mock and deride this stuff in many ways. But it does have really, I think, quite dramatic effects. I certainly think it has dramatic effects in education. I think it makes us duller. I know every generation thinks the next generation coming through is sort of lost, and its language is the first sign of their lostness. But this language is now everywhere. I mean, if it's not the kids coming home and saying "like" all the time is one thing, but when the family is reading articles about branding the family, developing a family brand, and when the language of the workplace, which used to be for the most part a place where the vernacular flourished, but this is the first attack on language which actually annihilates the vernacular as well as the public language, the formal language. And you can become obsessed, I know, but to listen to the way people speak, it's not the likes and the text language and all that sort of stuff that I find really concerning. It is the general dullness of the language on talkback radio everywhere. I mean, it's coming out of the workplace, out of all workplaces. Even plumbers use it. Now, to give you two examples of where there has, it seems to me, disastrous practical effects. If you take the idea of outcomes-based education. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me that most of you here did not have an outcomes-based education. You're too old, I'm sorry. And that's why you're morons. That's why you have trouble thinking about anything or reading books or doing anything at all, because your education was not outcomes-based. Good riddance. Now everyone gets an outcomes-based education, which is why they're so much cleverer than everyone else has been. And it all works so much better. They don't read any Shakespeare or do any of that, but you know, what sort of an outcome are you going to get from Shakespeare? Disastrous outcome. A non-outcome, if not an adverse one. Now, if you go to the Northern Territory and read the Northern Territory Education Department's mission statement or its website, it's hard to see where the mission statement begins and where the general gumph begins or ends, or I don't know. But you will see that it sounds like every other education department's mission statement and general promotional rubbish, with this difference that it's worse. It's even worse. And it describes in ways that, you know, the corporate plan is a living document that reinforces our commitment to ongoing improvement. to improve employment, education and training outcomes, and it provides a system of accountability for the whole department, including schools. Well, let's take that. Provides a system of accountability for the whole department. Well, I know one school in the Northern Territory very well. And it was built with government money after the first school was built with Melbourne Rotary money, built by Vietnam veterans. And the kids all there want to go to school, and their parents want them to go to school. It's in northeast Arnhem Land. The only trouble is that the teacher comes only 2 days a week, on average. And many other, and then there are other days when she's away on in-house internal customer training exercises. The kids, as a result, aged 14 or 15, are illiterate and innumerate, despite having gone to this school for several years. They just play in the dust. They're lost. If kids in the school down here miss, if their teacher misses a few days, the parents begin to panic. If they miss a few stages in their education, there's general panic, and it just won't happen. Not for long. Up there, it's just a matter of course. And yet, only a month or so ago, the college which is in charge of the administration of this school, which provides the teacher who turns up when it suits her, declared that these children, aged 16, had reached Year 11 standard. Now, I've sat with these kids, with Vietnam vets, and some of them had only reached Year 9 standard when they left school. And these people cannot spell or read or write or add up. They can't take 7 from 9 using blocks. They've never learned anything because they've never been taught properly. And yet the same business goes on. The outcome in these cases, as everywhere, where they talk about outcomes-based, it seems to me, the outcome is not for the so-called client or customer. The outcome is for the department, for the organisation. It set itself up so it can actually tick the box which says the outcome has been achieved. The values have been lived by. We have aligned them with our goals and our outcomes and everything works well. It's actually the most cynical operation you could imagine. It's Stalinist in conception and execution, seems to me. What you actually have, the outcome is a bunch of kids, 40 at one stage, but they're drifting away now. They're going into town because there's no one there to teach them. What you have is a bunch of kids whose life opportunities have been lost entirely. That's the outcome. But the outcome for the department and the school and everybody in between has been achieved. That's the first thing, and I think that happens very generally in modern organisations. The other one I just mentioned as quickly as I can is last year with the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria. If you lived in Victoria, if you lived in the bush, roughly speaking, which is where I live, you were constantly warned about the approach of fire events, weather events, fire events, combinations of weather events and fire events, wind events, heat events. Everything's an event now, as you know. As I said, we come out in a birth event and we go out in a death event. All this stuff went on for ages. Most people had gone and got their fire plans from the CFA and come away and installed their Honda pumps and their sprinkler systems and believed that they could really handle any fire. On the day, however, it emerged from the Royal Commission. The Country Fire Authority and the Department of Sustainability and Environment had been to management school. And as a result, they were unable to express, either before the fires or during the fires, the facts of the fires. In fact, they told the Commission that it was not possible for them to warn people about the fire in ways that might make them leave their houses because there had never been a fire like this before. It was unprecedented. See, once you believe that your language is entirely newfangled, you believe everything's newfangled. You think there's never been a fire before in the whole of history. So Jack Rush, the QC, who was assisting the Commission, said, surely if you had described the kind of fire that these weather conditions would produce, then people, instead of talking about fire events, then surely more people would have left. And they said, but we couldn't describe it because there had never been a fire like this before. So he went that night and found a description of the 1939 Black Friday bushfires and read it out to these people. And they said, oh, well, yeah, it might be, but, you know, and around they went. So really, in a way, what I mean to say is that having been trained in management language, they were unable to do the simplest thing that language does, which is to warn people. Fire, look out. Hot. Burn, you know, those things you do with kids. They couldn't do that. This is not hyperbole, believe it or not. This is actually, you can read the commission transcripts and there it is. Asked what they were doing on the day, they said, one said he was populating the template. I don't know whether he was doing that in a private room or where he was doing, but you would think it seems it's bizarre. Another said he was value-adding. Value-adding. Nowhere did they say, and this is, if you read Robert Mann's article in the Monthly Before Last, Robert and his family were up there, and he describes how no one actually wrote a warning between 3 o'clock in the afternoon until after 7. The warning was written and then was not delivered. The warning was written in, it wasn't the best warning I've ever seen, but at least it might have told people that the fire was coming. But the management system was such that they couldn't bring themselves to issue the warning. In other words, you can't really separate management language from management processes. And it seems to me they often don't work the way they're meant to work. And that once you start talking about outcomes-based and achieving outcomes aligned with your values and your goals and all the rest of it, you're really in huge trouble. And you've sort of given up a whole... your ability to act spontaneously and in many ways morally. I mean, Robert's article ends by saying, you know, with the policeman who's, you know, there's a body lying on the sports field, and he asked the policeman, could we cover that body? He says, not my job. Which is really the vernacular way of, sums up in the vernacular what management does. But at least he said, not my job, and didn't go into something else. Anyway, I'll leave it there, and if you have any questions and if there's any time, fire away.
Questions?
Thank you. Dar Johnson. One of my pet hates is the word vibrant. When politicians and planners and others want to persuade you that something is a good thing, they seem to use it consistently. What's your view of the word vibrant?
Look, it's not one of my core values. I do remember it. It came out around the time multiculturalism became fashionable. We know we had a vibrant multicultural society, and you couldn't have a multicultural society that wasn't vibrant. And then it just kept going. It was actually, you know, we used to, I remember, you could shorten it to VMC, vibrant multicultural, VMS, I mean, VMS. VMCS, whichever you like. No, it's another. It's died away a bit. Vibrant. I haven't seen as much of it recently, but I don't know what they've replaced. Probably robust. Amanda Vanstone, in a very short interview on the ABC a couple of years ago, used the word vibrant, robust, 13 times, and she was describing a psychological report into. I can't remember her first name. Ms. Rao. Who was deported for no reason. Yeah, but she said what they needed was a robust psychological report. Robust, robust, robust. I have the same view as you on vibrant.
Max Richardson, thank you the other day for your last book for talking about the use of verbs. I used it the other day to an educational outcome recipient.
Oh, good.
However, the word I hate from politicians is resile, because they use it as a positive thing, a negative thing, where I will not resile from that, where resile gives you resilient. It's a good thing to resile. and they use it the wrong way. And I get annoyed at people using cliches without understanding what those cliches mean. I know you've mentioned this in your books. So
I think we probably have to, you have to sort of stop listening. You'll go mad if you worry about resile and fulsome and literally and refute when you mean deny, and it's like possessive apostrophes and all those in the wrong places. I went to vote once in the Aries Inlet Hall, not the hall, the schoolroom they voted in, and down in Victoria. And as the voters came in, all the words were written on the board, and the plurals all had apostrophes on the blackboard. You know, they'd have one cat and two cats, and they had cats, C-A-T, apostrophe S. And I got the duster and took them all out, but it didn't. I'm sure they went back in on Monday morning, I suppose.
Albert Weiss, you mentioned Shakespeare and the poetry of Shakespeare. Do you consider that sometime in the future we may be able to use the current telephone texting language and convert it into poetry?
Well, I don't know. I've never seen... it's a physical miracle, the way some people can text. I don't know how they do it so quickly with their thumbs, but... if you still write kind regards on your texts, you know you're not doing well at the texting business. But it may be possible, actually, to put the Book of Common Prayer or something into a telephone, and then you will text in the English of Cranmer or something. I don't know. Anything's possible, but that's a good idea, actually. We can text in Elizabethan English, I think.
Zach Neulinger, I suspect I'm probably the youngest person in this room, so what would you suggest my generation actually do to try and fix this abominable mess?
Your outcome's based, obviously. Look, I don't know. I was on a panel in Perth the other day with A.C. Grayling, the English philosopher, who said, in answer to that question, just correct people all the time. Just pull them up. I thought, no, that's the worst thing you can do. grammarians can drive you barmy. And I didn't get much grammar myself, as no doubt is apparent to those who did. Country high schools didn't teach, I wish they had, didn't teach much grammar or much Latin. So pulling up people is a very unpleasant way of going about it. I think grammarians are among those people who couldn't live without bad grammar, if you know what I mean. They wouldn't know what to do with themselves if grammar was perfect. What would you do for a living? So don't do that. I think it's, in a way, I think it's good to satirise this as much as you can. I think I've always thought it would be a great idea to have a National Verb Retrieval Day, where everyone has to think of a verb and write it on the wall. I think equally both in-house and out-of-house moratoriums on certain words, like vibrant. We will not use vibrant all this week. Productivity would decline for the first couple of weeks as they sat there and tried to think of some other word for vibrant and then realised that you don't need an adjective at all. It'd be much better without it. But I think it would pick up soon after that. I think you could write to your local member on this sort of score. I think taking the trouble to write to people who send you silly things like that letter I quoted at the beginning is worth doing. Teaching your children words. I mean, my argument with the education system would be that confronted with what is a sort of... is not like any other assault on the English language. I mean, lots of people have worried about... from Sam Johnson on, they've worried about the inadequacies or the destruction or the depletion of English. George Orwell and others. And plenty have said in totalitarian systems how the language is the first thing to go. It's a well worth reading for this reason alone, but there are many others, reading the diaries of Victor Klemperer, who was a linguist, working in Dresden University at the time of Hitler's rise to power, and began to record first. The first thing he noticed about the repression of Nazism was the way that words had changed their meaning and how his language was being taken away from him. Long before his rights were taken away, that followed. Not that much time, but that was the first thing to go. Now, I'm not suggesting that this language is totalitarian, but it strangely imitates it. It really does. Stalin said, you know, we will decide what words mean and what they don't. That's really what, in organisations like this rather benign department I talked to a few weeks ago, that's really what is decided by PowerPoint and these things. They're deciding what words mean and what they don't. And these are the words you're going to use next time you go to your Six Sigma conference or any other new management. Some consultant comes through, you'll start using this word over and over again. And what it creates is the same kind of complicity that operates in an authoritarian organisation, because everyone has to use the word, otherwise you stand out. Your language gives you away every time. Speak that I may see thee. I mean, that's sort of inverted in an authoritarian system. So that if you speak the wrong word, if you use the wrong phrase in filling out your form, you are failing. You not only fail in your duty to the values and the mission statement, you reveal yourself as a rebel. You're no person not to be trusted. That doesn't answer your question at all. Just keep trying. But education systems, I think, should have said, well, in the face of this, what we will do is teach above all a love of words. Well, you know, we will teach people how wonderful words are. We'll give them that defence at least, rather than rolling over and saying, oh, well, what do you want us to do next? What would you like us to turn this little kid into? We'll take all this away from him. It's not important. They can go through school and never read a Shakespeare sonnet, even if they don't understand it. But somehow it sticks with them. They'll never know about the rhythms of language or have cadences echoing in their heads, you know, when they're on their deathbed.
Lynn Beasley.
Good name. I remember you.
When you're talking about phrases and things being introduced, it seems to me also that we go through phases where certain words become unpopular. And ones that you've been using just recently, I know, in a lot of museums, have been unpopular now for a number of years. And those are the words teaching and education. Mm. And I've talked a lot about this over a lot of time, because the word education to me has always meant something very positive, and yet it got dropped from a lot of museum language because it had negative connotations, and so we had to start using learning and interpretation. And we were no longer teachers, we were interpreters or learning facilitators. We here at the National Museum, we do call ourselves the education section, but I know there's lots of other museums where they're the learning section, and I keep wondering what they're learning.
Learning anything. They're taking home learnings.
I noticed in your talk you've talked about education and teaching a lot, but have you found this also is permeating into the education departments themselves in a way?
Very much. You can search education department documents, and you'll struggle to find the word teach or learn. You'll find virtually everything from it. And you can listen to Kevin and Julia all day long and all night, and you won't hear them talk about teachers. And it seems to me the strangest thing, and so separated from the reality of everybody's education, because I think if you asked anyone in this room what was most important to them in their education, I doubt very much they'd say it was a Bunsen burner or a gymnasium or a building of any kind, or even a sports ground. They would say it was two or three good teachers that they managed to get during their life. That's what did it. And they won't always be the same teachers. Some teachers are good for some people and some other. All you can hope to do is to put as many good teachers into the system as possible, and yet you never hear anyone ever say that. Instead, you have universities adopting quality assurance straight from the private sector, quality assurance, which leads them to ask students to judge their teachers as if that's going to tell you who are the good ones and who are the bad ones. Well, if someone had asked me as an undergraduate to tick, you know, to measure the good teachers from the bad, I would have got it upside down. The best teacher I ever had seemed to me at the time to be the worst teacher I'd ever run into in my life. It was only later I realised that he taught me 10 times as much and forced me to think in ways that no other teacher had ever done. So really what and university, the idea of universities having quality assurance of teachers just seems to me about, you know, the 100th thing that might be important. You'd never get to it, really. But they've picked it up because they see themselves as a customer-focused organisation.
We'll take one more question, because we're...
Alex.
Just here it was. Yeah. Just here.
Jane Freebury. I was just wondering what you... On the end? Like this? I was just wondering what you thought of the work of the plain English societies that have sprung up in England, and I believe there's one that has begun here in Australia.
Well, I'm not opposed to them. But I'm not sure that they... they're a bit close to the grammarians, which I think are fine in their way. Who was it? Someone in the room will know, but who was it complained about the grammar schools? Well, it might have even been Shakespeare. Somewhere in one of Shakespeare's plays he talks about these grammar schools. I think they're a bit inclined to... Look, it's a good thing if people know how you compose a sentence and all that. That's great. I mean, it gives... I'm all for it. There's my answer. Except that I think they sometimes think that they can cure everything with a few in-house seminars. When, in fact, really grammar... Treating grammar when you're dealing with management language, I think, is like treating dandruff when you've got... gangrene. You really are, you're well gone. And grammar's not going to help. This is beyond the reach of grammar. It really is. It's an anaesthetic. Which all will use that term. You know, the best essay of the 20th century, in my view, Politics in the English Language. Well, maybe that's going too far. It's certainly a marvellous thing. And you can read it 100 times and it's still a marvellous thing. But he talked about this anaesthetic quality and he has this image of the cliché sort of marching in, the well-worn phrases coming in and taking over the whole of any document. And in one of his diaries, he talks about how no one of the educated classes understands that the uneducated classes don't ever listen to an abstract noun. They can't. They don't hear them. If it's abstract, they don't hear it. Now, what's happened in a way is that everyone now deals in the abstract. And that seems to me disastrous for the language, because it not only means that the public language, a formal or official language, is dull and very conducive to lying and obscuring the truth, including the truth from yourself, but it also wipes out the vernacular as well. So it removes the creative force of the language as it was spoken by my friend up in Mount Isa. So plain English, good, but it's not the answer.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll leave it there. Don Watson, thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.